Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about sort of finishing up looking at kind of our symbolic execution ideas and thinking about sort of more approximate ways of trying to check if programs behave correctly. So just kind of on the same idea of thinking about bug finding, we talked a little about, well, you know, what can we do to make this technique more practical if we aren't so concerned about getting precise results? And we saw like some semblances of this idea and all the practical things we did to make symbolic execution work, where we took approximations. But there were some approximations, because we were still doing execution, that we just weren't taking. And we talked about this kind of static analysis where we choose other trade-offs and do things like say, you know, I'm going to like not just track possible code paths. I'm just going to say, I'm going to track a superset of them, for example. We track, you know, don't bother checking the conditions like we do with symbolic execution. And also where we don't like track the actual values, we aren't doing execution, we just check some abstraction that should be easier to compute. Like, what are the things this pointer could possibly point to? What are, you know, the possibilities as far as whether this value is allocated or not? And tracking that kind of summary information, which should make our analysis easier. And if we tune it in certain ways, possibly still precise, or maybe we make precise in a certain sense, in the sense of being at least sound or complete, depending on our trade-offs we choose, you know, finding bugs of a certain sort. And kind of that approach kind of talked about at a high level. I mentioned that there are tools for doing this, and that, well, I started by thinking, let's do like use after free bugs, and well, that's not what the tools are actually good at, because it turns out that the approximations make that, you know, kind of imprecise, and even with those approximations, it's still pretty slow. It's not as slow as symbolic execution across a big program is, but it's slow. So typically the analysis are done on smaller pieces of code, or looking for bug patterns that are not so complicated to the bookkeeping to find, like say SQL injection, where, well, we're just looking for, is this SQL value parameter a constant or not? Then we talked about our main topic for today, which is going to be sandboxing. And we mentioned kind of one of the biggest difficulties of this idea of running applications without more privileges than they actually need, which is that, well, a lot of applications, like in the corner case, need a lot of privileges, and it's hard to sort of describe, you know, the limitations we kind of have intuitively about what the application should have in a way that we can actually enforce it. And then we started introducing this idea of, well, you know, if we can't easily sandbox whole applications, which we might revisit, can we sandbox the important parts of the application? And we had this example of, let's say we had a video decoding library that we assume has some sort of buffer overflow in it. And we want to run it in a way where that buffer overflow will be limited in the adverse effects it can cause. And we talked about, well, a strategy for doing this is that if we can filter the system calls the program can make, the system calls are how it interacts with any resources. This gives us the ability to effectively limit what it should do to, you know, specific operations. We talked about, like, for our video decoding library, it just needs to kind of read the encoded video and output the decoded one. It's a very simple filter that privilege separation gives us. And this system call filtering idea kind of works pretty well for that. And we'll look at kind of extending that system call filter idea and talk a little more about the format that has and, you know, how much we can actually do when we're going beyond the case of, I have this library which is entirely kind of self-contained. In that case. So questions about things we covered last time? So based on looking at the quiz this morning, I'm going to go over a bunch of quiz questions. So quiz question two was asking about fixing a circular reference issue, where what I didn't show here is that calendar contains a vec of RC ref cells to entry, calendar entry. I think, but maybe that wasn't relevant here. So, and one question was asked, like, what operations could we do? Option B was saying, could we make a new calendar entry with different attendees but in the same document? And the answer is no, because RefCell does not allow sharing. There's one copy of a document that is modifiable. That's what the RefCell does, and it's modifiable in place, meaning we can get a reference to it, we can borrow a reference to it temporarily and modify the ref cell that's in this, the document that's in this calendar entry. But we can't share that with another document. There's no counting to actually like make that possible, or to have two documents usefully, two entries usefully have the same document. You know, those would be separate ref cells with separate tracking of who's borrowing them, and that wouldn't work. We need to have the same tracking of who's borrowing them. That actually needs to be the same for it actually to be the same document. So we can make one with a document that's a copy of that, and that's not the same as the same document. Yeah?
So if you did do B anyway, where would that go wrong? Because after the grades were released, I went and like Illinois this and refs just to see what the error was. And like I couldn't make it have any issues unless I was starting to do weird operations.
So how were you making them be the same document?
But I just passed in the document as like parameter when I'm making a new object. And it didn't give me a error.
If you're just passing in the document, not a reference to the document, a document, you were probably moving the document from one to the other, so you couldn't use the original after that. Because remember, when we talked about vecs, like calling a function with a raw vec, it just moved in.
Yeah, I might have forgotten to test the original one.
Yeah, so probably, yeah, so you can move it from one to the other, but that's not, that doesn't mean that we have them simultaneously usefully having the same document. Answer your question? Okay. And option D was asking about removing an attendee from an entries list and updating the attendee's calendar. And this is doable, should be doable, provided that there's only one writer for the ref cells for the calendar of the attendee at a time. So where we might run into trouble with this is if we access the calendar entry by using attendee A, and then we try to use that to remove, to then access attendee A and then remove, we need a special case to realize, oh, we're already accessing the calendar entry through this attendee. We can't remove the attendee at the same time. But if we're not doing that, it's not a problem. The ref cell is going to check, you know, at runtime, make sure that we're not trying to modify the calendar while we're accessing using the calendar to read the calendar entry. But as long as we're reading the calendar entry from a different attendee, it should be fine. And if we're reading from the same, we could have a special case saying, oh, I'm removing the calendar entry from the attendee I originally found. I can make sure I use the copy I got originally and update that so we don't have a dangling pointer. And I need to remember what question three on the quiz was. So question three was asking where we would have a runtime error. and adding an entry to an appendee we had a mutable reference to. It was an immutable reference. And that's fine because a ref cell, the cell type is meant to make things mutable. The cell type is mutable. You know, the internals of it are, even if the outside object is immutable. I think that's what probably got most people off guard. Allows this interior mutability pattern. Whether that's good code design, you can probably say things about. But that's what it allows, and we saw that being used in like implementing RC. RCs were read-only, but had this mutable count internally using the cell idea. And multiple references to different entities, same calendar entry, that's fine, because as long as we don't access the calendar entry at the same time. For writing. Because there's runtime checking of how many people are borrowing this calendar entry for reading and writing. As long as that doesn't violate the rules at runtime, it's no problem. That's how the ref cell works. Now there was a question about changing things to weak. And I think the best way, the best solution to how do we avoid, I guess I'd first say there's a problem with this code as is, which is that we have this circular reference where an attendee references is referenced by a calendar entry, which references a calendar, which references again. So we have this circular dependency. And this means our counts will never get to go to zero. Because if we stop referencing an attendee, well, it still has a reference to it, so it's not going to get freed. We stop referencing a calendar entry, well, it still has a reference to the attendee back to it, so it's not going to get freed kind of automatically. And I think the best fix for this is probably to change that to weak. The assumption of this fix is that we have an external list of attendees that we're going to keep around. And so the attendees won't go away, even though this is a weak reference to them, because the external list of attendees will do it. And if it does go away, when we look at a calendar entry, it's going to say, hey, you have these attendees minus this one, I don't know who it is anymore. That's the sort of format we get for that. If alternately we changed this to be weak, then we'd say that for that to make sense, we have to have something else referencing calendar entries to make that go away. Because the weak reference isn't going to be enough to have the calendar entry not be deallocated. So something else we need to do that, and I think it's possible we have like a global database of calendar entries or something like that, but I think it seems unlikely in this design we would. So probably that sounds like your calendar entries just disappear. And if we make them both weak, this means that that only makes sense if we have an external list of attendees and calendar entries, or else they're going to get sort of freed from under us. Like, it will avoid the memory leak, but it's going to probably create other problems, except if we have this very particular design where we have, for some reason, a global list of calendar entries and a global list of attendees. That's, you know, going to make sure that we don't free those despite the weak references. So questions? This one. Okay, so then question 5 was about sort of where coverage-guided testing would be helpful. So talk about common and wrong answers. So here, I think coverage information wouldn't help because our coverage information is just going to say, yes, we ran that equality test every time. So we're not going to do any better than random testing because all our coverage-guided testing is doing is like biasing our random test towards things that seem to give us more coverage or cover different cases. It's always going to be the same in this case, so it's not going to help. In this case, our coverage-guided testing is going to help us kind of work incrementally through this statement. Unfortunately here, I don't think that really ends up helping overall. So our coverage-guided testing is kind of going to divide us into cases where x doesn't equal y and x equals y, and it's going to help us in that. Well, we can start with cases where x equals y a lot more often than random testing would. The problem is, if we start with a case where x equals y and change it randomly, almost certainly x doesn't equal y anymore. So that actually doesn't really end us helping overall in finding a case where x plus y also equals 4. And you saw the cases where it was more helpful were where, you know, we could take advantage of having an input that gives us one set of coverage, and little changes to the input would change our coverage slightly. This is a case where little changes to the input are going to dramatically change our coverage, basically the same way choosing a new random input would. It's not actually more helpful to start with a quote-unquote good input. So questions on our coverage testing idea? Yeah.
So for C, it's better to have coverage because we have to start with that correct piece of x equals y, or am I not?
For C, it's not better to have coverage.
Okay.
Because even though coverage will help us start with cases of where x already equals y, our mutation operations are unlikely to maintain that property, given that we aren't like solving equations, right? We're just choosing random, making random changes to x and or y. And those random changes are pretty likely to disrupt x equals y. Where it would be helpful is if, like, instead of x plus y equals 4, it was like x plus z equals 4, then it would be super helpful, right?
Okay. Because
then making a random change, a bunch of those random changes would only change z, and that would be a really good strategy to find a case that matched it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and I'll also do my assignment Q&A. So if you've still looked up, we have a fuzzing assignment, which is using AFL++, the kind of de facto modern version of AFL. And I'll put questions on that at this point. I'll ask again Wednesday, but let's see. Okay, so we finished up last time. We looked at this system call filtering API. I mentioned there's this simple version where we just say, we call a function and say, only allow read, write, accept, and sync return. That was enough for our example of implementing that video decoder library. But there's kind of this more fine-grained interface where we can write this little program that runs to try to check what system calls are allowed. And this program, it has this kind of little assembly-like language, which doesn't have a real assembly language, so I'm showing you C macros that produce the machine code, because that's how it's specified. They say, the machine code has this format. And there's like no official tool that has an assembly language, so that's where it left. But we have this operator which loads this number field, which is this identifier for which system call it is, into an accumulator. Then we check if the accumulator equals the constant syswrite. And depending on that, we either go ahead one instruction or zero. In this case, executing kind of kill the process or return. And we can have kind of more complicated examples. So here, I'm doing the same, check if it's a write, and if it is, go ahead. Otherwise, run this kill process. And then I say load the first argument of the system call into the accumulator and check if it's equal to 2. And if so, allow it. Otherwise, kill the process. So we can kind of implement kind of arbitrary rules this way, and there's operations like less than and all that stuff. And there's actually an extended form that's really supported that I'm not going to show, where there's 10 more registers than just the accumulator. So you can do really things. And the reason why this interface is chosen is that, it was originally developed for packet filtering. but it's kind of this generic way where we can look at these kind of machine code instructions and verify in advance that it doesn't have any loops and that there are no out of bounds accesses to anything. And we can implement this by converting it to an assembly function that runs in the kernel, in the side of the OS, in the system call handler, in this case, and just gets called like a normal function and runs as fast as assembly. And so this is why that interface is chosen and why this is actually a very efficient filter, you know, versus, you know, older techniques would have involved like doing something like what a debugger does, which means that like we make a system call and it runs another program to figure out if the system calls allow, and that's really slow. This doesn't need to do that. That's why we're writing filters in this way. And this provides us the ability to kind of implement arbitrary rules while doing that. Do I have the slides for this? I guess not in the other place. So in an upcoming homework, next week's homework is sandboxing. We're gonna be using, right, making a setcom filter. You're probably not gonna use this format. There's a library called libsetcomp, which basically makes it a little more intuitive, but it's using this interface to actually talk to the OS. And by a little more intuitive, I mean you can just say allow write, and it will write the appropriate code to do that. So a challenge with kind of using this idea is that it's kind of, there's two challenges. So one we alluded to last time is that like we can't check certain arguments. The other is that there's like lots of system calls. So here I'm writing a program that is not very complicated, and strace is a utility that will tell you what system calls a program makes on Linux and other Unix systems. And you can see that we have a whole bunch of other system calls being made that are part of this program startup. So if we just wanted to set a filter that can do everything we need to run the Hello World program, that filter is actually pretty complicated. You know, and this is like allocating space on the heap, setting up thread local storage, even though we're not using multiple threads, the C library is prepared just in case we are. Also, thread local storage is how stack canaries work. So stack canaries won't work if that system call doesn't work. And other initializations, config files for the linker, and the C library, things like that. Then I'd say, okay, so let's limit system calls, you know, just after startup though, right? That's just startup stuff. What we can do is we can allow the startup stuff to run in some, you know, and then set a system call filter. Because, you know, we're not doing anything dangerous in the startup typically. But the other problem is that you kind of have to look at the program and the C library very carefully to figure out what system calls it runs. So on the next slide, I have an example which does fopen, fprintf, fclose, right, using the C library. What do we think the names of the system calls for this are going to be? And if you looked at the list of Linux system calls, you know, there's nothing called fopen or fprintf because these are library functions that call lower level things. And probably the list you'd come up with, if you say, well, this is open, this is write, and this is close. And any other operations you think we need? Okay. So this is not going to be the actual list of system calls made by the program. So who has a guess as to where we're going to have a problem? And I will say that I would not have guessed the problems we've got. let's look at what strace says. The system calls we actually make are open at, not open. There's an open is a different system call. If we're filtering it, it's specified with a different sys underscore number. You have to check. New fstat, after it opens it, it figures out what does that file descriptor correspond, what type of file is that? So it makes this new fstat call, and then it's writing close. Right, so this simple example, I basically had to run the program to figure out what to put in my system call filter, or I need to look really carefully at the Linux system call list to figure out, oh, I want to allow open, but there's actually these whole other ways to do open. I have to allow all of them. And, I need to think about, it might want to figure out what the properties of the file are. Probably need to allow do fstat at and fstat and calls. This gets to be a mess. And it gets to be a real mess, in kind of more realistic examples. So let's say I want to allow retrieving a file from the network. So here we go. I'm just going to use the curl library to read test.txt from an HTTPS server. And there's a lot of weird system calls that happen that we probably wouldn't have guessed. Like, there's the obvious things, like actually opening up the socket, the TCP socket, to the server. This stuff is all before that. So we're like reading a configuration file for OpenSSL. We're using inter-thread synchronization because this library is designed to handle multiple threads. We're getting information on our system. We're opening a UDP socket and a local socket to communicate with a local name cache, probably. Or actually, to a local socket to communicate internally in our program, actually. We're setting up signal handlers for internal use in our program. There's a lot of extra stuff going on that you wouldn't have guessed. And also, like, this is starting to get really difficult to write a filter that we're convinced doesn't allow the program to do things that we don't want it to do. in this sort of case. And also, like I mentioned last time, we have the problem that we also can't really check things like file names, right? Open is probably one of our biggest concerns. And there's lots of ways of doing open that we need to be concerned about. So we're going to have a different kind of solution to practically filter out things related to like file names and such, which uses something completely different than the filter the system calls idea. And also kind of the, there are programs that do this kind of filtering, but doing it for kind of just existing libraries, well, you're going to start half, it gets tricky to maintain that list of filters. This is not a very small interface if we're thinking about running kind of code that does something even a little bit complicated, like getting a file from a web page. And as you can see, there are lots of system calls. Lots of them. And this is on Linux. I understand Windows is like 3 times higher. So. Oh, and I do have the slide on this. Okay, so for the assignment, we're not going to write BPF programs by hand. So the library I'm going to recommend using, you don't have to, allows you to like set up these particular rules, and it will write the BPF program and load it up. But it's just a shorthand, but you can see how it's working and why you can write a library like this. Okay. So we talked about the difficulty of filtering, but despite it being kind of difficult, this is kind of the basis for this common pattern I alluded to with that video decoder example of privilege separation. And I'm going to talk about two examples of real programs that use privilege separation. I'm going to start with OpenSSH, the most popular SSH implementation. And it probably is the first real implementation of this pattern. So they were doing this before there was system call filtering like really available. So the way they implemented it is that they made a separate user for the internal use of the SSH server, and also something called chroot, which we'll talk about later, which is related to isolating the file system. And their idea was that they wanted to have the network processing code be separate from the code which figures out, should I let this person log in? So if there's some security buffer overflow in the network processing code, all it can do is make bogus requests for, please let this person log in, the password is X. And that's not going to be any more useful than what you could do from the network anyway. And also, we'd have a separate one of these processes per connection, so there'd be no sharing between users, ideally. And their implementation is they started a separate process that communicated back and forth with this monitor program to actually do sensitive operations. And what they defined as sensitive operations were all the cryptographic operations. So the idea is when we had a buffer overflow, you never got access to the server's keys. You had access to an API that you could use to make requests about the server's keys, but you couldn't get the value of the server's keys. You could ask to switch the connection over to an authenticated connection for a user, and if so, what the monitor program would do is it would say, okay, now you're done, we'll start a new process as that user for this connection because you gave me the right password. And so the idea of this design is that we have this, you know, our main server program is the monitor, and it kind of forwards all the connection stuff, goes to this unprivileged process that communicates back and forth with the monitor to say, hey, I'd like to do this sensitive thing. And the hope is that all we need to worry about is, are these operations implemented securely? Is the ask for a cryptographic operation, you know, is that done securely? Does it only allow good operations? Does it not like leak the key? Does the switch to the user operation actually check for the password or whatever else we need? That's what we need to check. And we don't need to actually sort of verify our implementation of all the network handling and message handling, because that's going to be done in this sandbox where the worst that can happen is it can make bogus requests to authenticate a user or, you know, sign messages to verify the server is who it actually is that basically are the same the connection could legitimately do. But hopefully it's a simpler interface. And adding this was relatively simple. So they needed to write about 3,000 lines for all the communication and process setup and all that, and then change 950 lines to use that. But this is not something we can just sit down with any old program and do. They needed a lot of knowledge of how OpenSSH worked internally to figure out what stuff do I put in this sandbox process and what do I keep outside it. But this is kind of a better application design from the standpoint of doing least privileged stuff. So questions about this privilege separation design in OpenSSH? So probably the most common version of this privilege separation design these days is web browsers. So pretty much every web browser out there uses a version of this privilege separation design, and earlier versions of Chrome kind of pioneered doing this for web browsers. Before that, typically the web browser ran all as kind of one process where there was a security flaw in any part of the browser, it could access all the other parts of the browser. And when Chrome was initially deploying this, they said, well, we're going to make kind of what we think is the most sensitive part of the web browser, which is the part which draws the web page. That's the part that seems most error-prone to us. We want to make that run in a separate process. So we'll set up a process that will handle figuring out how to draw the web page, and it's going to communicate with the main part of the browser, which they call the browser kernel, via sort of IPC, meaning inter-procedure communication, inter-process communication. So they'll just send messages back and forth. And kind of the idea is that the browser kernel is sending the content to render, and it's getting back pictures to display. And actually, the rendering engine like kind of handled the whole display of the web page. So in their original design, you know, they basically implemented these browser kernel commands that the sandbox could output. They could say, I want to show this image on the screen. I want to make a request to this URL. I want to download files to the local file system. And I want to upload a file that the user selects. And the browser kernel would send, hey, the user clicked here, that kind of information. So they wrote their own protocol for this. But their hope is that this interface is an easier thing to keep secure than the here's a web page render it interface. And they implemented kind of restrictions to limit what you know could happen in the event of a compromise, right? So don't make a request for this URL. They kind of filtered what URLs are allowed by the sandbox. Like if you make a request for a file URL, we're just going to say no. This doesn't mean that like it's powerless. Like you can still read any website using this. Like so, this design wasn't, you know, it was better, but it didn't maybe solve all our problems as far as if the browser is compromised, what can you do? Well, you can access, in this design, every URL as that you're logged into, you can get the contents of. For downloading to a local file system, obviously it would be bad if we could just like overwrite arbitrary files. They just made it so you can download to the downloads folder. Like, so that's limited utility. And for uploading user requested files, right, you don't can't specify the file name, you just the browser kernel displays the file chooser. So, you know, the web page can't decide when those files are accessed. So questions on the idea of this interface. And since kind of this original version of the interface, we've realized that kind of this idea is a problem. And also in the original version, the usual idea is that you kind of run one process for all the rendering of all web pages. And this obviously has an issue that generally we're sharing things between web pages. So if one web page is compromised, it learns things about the other ones. So since the original version, Chrome and pretty much all the other web browsers, including Firefox, have switched to a model where they have this kind of separate process for rendering the web page and doing all the HTML and JavaScript processing. And not only do they have that kind of separate process, they have a separate one for each site, typically for each registered domain name. This is a lot more processes. And there's a lot of tricky cases in implementing this. The biggest thing is that web pages can embed other web pages, and making that work is complicated, and there are trade-offs there. So for example, on our course website, I have an office hour calendar. That's from Google. That's a web page embedded in another web page. If we want to have this per-process isolation model, you know, we need to do something where either some of the Google pages are displayed on the Virginia.edu process, or we have more inter-process communication or something like that. And also, like when we click a link, this might require switching to a new process, and we have to handle all that. So questions about this site isolation? Yeah. Okay, so we've talked about privilege separation. Let's say I want to apply this idea to my mail client. I have a mail client that's standalone, not in a web browser, just a mail client. Where should, if I want to apply this privilege separation idea to hopefully make my mail client more resilient to if I have security bugs in it, where should I try to do it? What parts of the program should I be concerned about? So start with the first question, which is where in my mail client are we concerned that there might be a security bug that would be worth working around? Yeah.
I think the most obvious one is emails coming in from someone unknown that can have potentially arbitrary content that has to be rendered.
So rendering email content, okay. Anything else? So rendering email content, that's one thing. I can think of one other thing I would be concerned about. Yeah. What about mail in transit?
Like, some of the security problems, somebody could be on the network, like sniffing.
Okay, so mail intercepted in transit, okay. I think that is a legitimate thing to be concerned about. Unfortunately, sandboxing won't help us. But it's definitely a thing to be concerned about. Yeah. So I think there's something else where sandboxing might be helpful. If you're concerned about security problems. Yeah. Other programs reading mail. So I agree, that's a concern. Unfortunately, we want the other programs to be privilege separated, not the mail one. Or otherwise confined. So the question of how to do that is a different one, but a related question. Yeah?
I don't know if this falls into rendering email content, but content scripting.
I think that's, a subset. Yeah.
Maybe something to do with other things, including emails, like attachments or links.
Okay, so rendering email content, I would say that's probably including attachments, links in emails. So something else I would say I'd be concerned about is bugs, parsing exchanges with malicious mail servers. So if we have a buffer overflow in our networking code, that's not a mail content problem, but that's still, pretty bad if I connect to the wrong mail server and my mail client now is running code chosen by that mail server operator. Because we might trust Google to handle our mail, we probably don't trust Google to run arbitrary programs on our machine. Or someone who's, replaced this mail certificate. So some of these problems we can solve, some of these problems we can mitigate with privilege separation, some of them we can't, right? So cross-site scripting type problems, maybe privilege separation can help a bit with how we render things. Other programs reading the mail, legitimate thing to be concerned about. Unfortunately, we kind of need to deal with have the OS or other help us in ways that are not just changing our program. Intercepted mail, intercepted in transit, that's a very good concern. That's going to be kind of a TLS type thing. But I would say our rendering email content and any bugs with exchanging with our network handling code, we could possibly mitigate by dividing up our program with privilege separation. So what should my Well, so let's start with rendering email content. So what should our interface look like for this? So we're going to have the rendering content part be a separate process. And then the question is, what are our messages that go back and forth between the main mail process look like? Yeah.
I think it's similar to the web browser example. It's a lot of like, I don't know how emails are actually like structured in code, but like you would just like main mail process would say like, okay, here's this, like go render it, and then the rendering thing will say, oh, I need you to get this image, I need you to get this. Like you would give the code or the content, and then it would get back the rendered image.
Okay, so you would send the mail message and get back an image of it primarily. Yeah. As for how our email is formatted, they can be HTML, in the worst case. Which case, we're rendering HTML, which indeed is very similar. And I guess we're... How about for our kind of network communication part? So if we want to isolate that, in case we have bugs in our network communication code, like a buffer overflow, what are our messages back and forth in this case? Someone tell me one thing. So our idea is that I want my network communication, in case I like have buffer overflows and dealing with the protocols to talk to actual mail servers, we want that to be isolated from the rest of the mail program. What do I... What's the interface look like for that? Not secret. So I would think probably we'd send the server info plus any messages to send, and we get back sort of result, success, failure, plus messages received, right? We'd have an API like that. And also probably requests for specific messages. And we might have more operations, like if we can delete messages on the server, that's probably one of them. So other commands, sort of move, delete, message. Yeah.
How is this different than just using a proxy server?
How is this different than using a proxy server in between? So it kind of looks like that, yeah. So our hope for this to be more secure is that the interface that we have here is easier to make secure on the main program side than the one that like we actually have, you know, with the network or as far as like processing the files. I think for the rendering case, that's obvious. For the networking case, it's not so obvious. But that interface is actually going to be implemented more securely, because if we have two things implemented insecurely, we still lose. Okay. So questions on this privilege separation idea? Okay. So that's privilege separation. Okay. So our last few minutes, we talked about, you know, the issue with that filtering system calls is pretty hard. So like if I want to just run like a video player filtering system calls, it's a lot. And also another reason why, you know, filtering this is hard is that often there are things that don't just involve system calls that we want to filter. So for example, on Linux or OS X, the way we talk to the screen is not through system calls, it's by sending messages to another program. And that's a whole other API with a whole other set of calls. So as kind of our, you know, I guess I'll introduce our kind of other isolation technique, and one that's kind of more practical for the confining an application, then system calls, and that will deal with finally our file system idea, is that we're going to have things which change what operation things a program can name. So rather than trying to filter the calls, we'll change what files exist as far as the program's concerned. So we'll talk about what that looks like next time, but that's going to be kind of an additional process isolation mechanism, and that's going to finally give us a useful answer for how do I let the program just open up the keyboard and not anything else. And that's where we'll finish up. Start next time, since I'm out of time right now.